Mr. Robinson, real too. We're talking about your time as a school lad in Heston, and we're talking about sources of information, really. What about the newsreels, the Pathé and the other films that were shown at the cinema? Were they much of an influence on you?
Yes, in a way. They put together a lot of the information we can do over the way, and that's what we've seen in the press, and brought us to life. But again, it was unfortunately, some of them were a little bit crazy by the time they reached the screen. They didn't talk about the action that might have happened several weeks previously, or not goodness knows when, really. So the time scale of some of the information, it was more propaganda type. Information.
Now, well, as you got to the end of your school time, you left school at 16, which would be rough 1941-ish. What did you plan to do? And was the war hanging over you? Did you think you'd have to serve eventually?
That's right. Well, I did take a view that if the war lasted, well, another couple of years, they involved in it. So I thought of that. But what I wanted to do was not go into an office where it was just an office. I wanted to go into an office of somewhere, perhaps, where they were making something, where they were making product, where you said, we make that sort of thing. And because the school had a type of job seeking, as it would be called, activity. They said, well, we think you ought to go and work in the shipping office. And I said, well, I can't quite see why I shouldn't really. They said, well, we think you ought to go and go for an interview. So I was sent to what was called in those days the Merchant Navy pool, where they looked all the Merchant Navy was nationalised at about the in a group for wartime purposes. And when I got there, I realised this wasn't quite what it was. I still wanted to work in the factory. So work and work there ahead of the end product. So I decided I'd walk, take a visit down the Great West Road, where there's a lot of factories from about half a down, leading down to Hammersmith and Hamilton Fair. But of course, in those days, factories didn't have the names outside outside their buildings because of, in case there was an invasion. And I went into the first one, very big building. And I said, I'm leaving at the successful, I want a job here, this sort of thing. And they said, well, just will you go and see Mr. So-and-so, go along that corridor there and up the staircase. And I followed all the instructions, I thought, for the lesson, and finished up out of the street again. And I told me, I'm turning somewhere. So I thought, this didn't interest me greatly. So I thought, well, I can't go back in there and look a bit foolish. So I walked on a bit further and came to this not so high a building. And I went in there and I said, went through the same thing, personnel person there. And very, very, very helpful, charming, all the rest of it. And she said, well, go and fill this form in, we're very interested. And I said, well, might I just ask a question for Sandy? What's the name of this place and what do you make here? Well, she can't tell you what we make, there's all top secret stuff, but it sounds all wartime stuff. And
the what gyroscope?
The Sperry gyroscope, American firm, Sperry gyroscope company. And they, as I mentioned, they made marine compasses, these gigantic things that used to exist, ship stabilizers, and aircraft instruments. The blind pilot, George, what was called, the equipment. And they also made things called Type X machine, which was a top secret decoding machine that the Americans had invented. And which I found out about 3 months ago. And years trying to find out what that was, and I didn't have the letters or something. Anyway. And then I was told to come in, it was a junior truck. My friend had just got a job at 25 shillings a week, so I wanted to make sure that I got something out of them. They said, well, we'll give you 22 and 6 shillings a week. And I thought, well, I'm going to be a little bit put down by this. So I said, well, do you think I could have 25 shillings after I've been here this while? And they said, yeah, we'll probably do something like that. And after about 3 weeks, they called me and said, yes, you can have 25 shillings a week. And they said, we noticed some more an application saying you can write shorthand. So I said, well, I know, I'm at the school, I'm shorthand. He says, well, the manager would like you to take the letter from him, but you don't want to type it, you want to read it back to his secretary for the letter. So I thought, you know, this is the end, I thought. But anyway, I muddled through this, and managed most of it. It was quite simple, he was quite fair about it. And I gave it to the secretary, and she read my shorthand, and she wrote, but it was pretty basic stuff, really, compared to what she'd been doing. And it was fine, so it's worth it. It's worth me 25 shillings a week now. And yeah, great. Went home pleased. It's cost another 10-6 months, which of course was quite a lot of money in those days. Yeah. And I went from there after about 6 months. They said, we want you to work out.
So, what were your duties, your range?
It was a general dog's body, really, like junior, absolutely junior club. I had to get tea, was one of the things, and it wasn't as simple as it sounded, because I had to go to the canteen I had and get a tray about this size, 4 mugs of tea, and carry it back to the office. Just quite through the factory doors and all this stuff into the office, which is inside the factory. And the first day I did this, first time I did this, in my brand new suit, the door swung out, hit the tray, and the lot went down the front of me. I went, this isn't very bad. I was very upset about this, and they said, well, I can carry it if it's ahead. And they said, we won't ask you to do it, but Miss Sunset will let me ask you to do it, and she can do it, you won't mind doing it. So I got pulled over that one quite easily. And then they asked me to do various things, work out this and mathematical things. They're working out. It was the production planning department where they were working out how much material to buy for various components. And so I had to work out how many times so I need bits of metal and nuts and bolts and all sorts of stuff. And eventually they said, after about 3 months, we want you to work out complete calculations for the whole instrument. And I gave you one of the central ones, which had about a dozen items on it to work out. And it stuck to the paper so I could work out. It was a blueprint, a materials blueprint. And I did that quite successfully. I started to make the little ones, which ran into pages and sub-assemblies, which was quite a few pages involved. And so eventually onto the big ones. And after doing that for about 6 months, I said, well, what we'd like to do now is to be on to progress in all of this in the factory. That means chasing up the factory people and all that sort of thing. So I did that for virtually right up until my Air Force days, really. And that involved, in those days, of course, various duties. You got things thrust upon you. You didn't have a particular job.
So how would you progress an order? I mean,
well, you had to... Well, you knew when it was due for it to be made. You knew that certain things were required to be in a certain place at a certain time. You had to make sure that those bits of metal, those nuts and bolts, were actually there. They'd arrived then, they were in the stores, they were able to be drawn out. And you made out the, if they were there, then you could make out a requisition order and give it to the production people to draw that material. And because they went mad if the material wasn't there, but it was usually there, but in some other part of the factory, you know, they put the wrong place, this sort of thing. So it spent quite a long time running all over the place, going to various departments. Good experience, really, because you learned what other people did as opposed to you. Up to that point, you thought everything was, you did everything, so you realised that it was just a tiny part and a big outfit. And as time went, of course, people left to go into the forces. And you were left there with the elderly ones who were rather aged or unfit to go in. They'd been to medicals and families who were unfit. And you've got more responsibility trusted upon you. And of course, your wage went up a bit then. And I left, I think, £2.50, which I can't get some records. Because it would be quite a good day. My father thought, £2.50? I've never got anything like that. And so it was... Yeah, we thought it was okay. But I knew all the time, knowing it, of course, that my lifetime there might be quite short with the war, so it wasn't, not no sign of it.
Did you know much about the machines you were making? I mean, you know, I mean, did you understand anything about the sort of how they worked and what they were?
I was interested in watching the assembly, the final assembly of some of them, especially the aircraft instruments, strangely enough. But more interested because the gyroscopic compasses I made were one of the fascinating parts of how. I mean, if you've had a toy or a gyroscope that stays in that position, it tells me how an aircraft instrument can operate in that basis. And they showed me this gyroscopic compass. They had an aircraft there. They just had a model of this, and just spun it around, just touched it like that, and go on spinning it. Seemed very soon. The precision was so marvellous, really, to me. That impressed me, all that sort of the technology. It was nothing compared to the day, of course, but in those days, relatively, it was high tech stuff.
So, by the end, as you were getting better and better paid, you were enjoying the work?
I enjoyed the work, yes, and I don't know who it worked for. I suppose in today's terms, that they would be completely unlike any American run firm. They were very American oriented in a way. They're proud of the fact that they were American, but they all the British people, there were no Americans there at all.
Now, the other thing, you joined the Air Training Corps, ATC.
That's right.
What made you decide to join them?
Well, a friend of mine actually said, why don't we join? It was only a short distance away from where we lived, but the bus ride came to Alvarez. We went along together one day. He wanted to be a pilot in the Air Force, and I wanted to be a ground crew, radio person, well, it's all right, because I didn't think I had the stamina or the physical capability of being a pilot or being an aircraft. I thought it just demanded something that I hadn't got. That's how we first joined it.
How did you go about joining? You went to Hounslow East?
That's right, we just went along one evening.
What sort of establishment was it?
It was in a school, yeah.
And how did you join? I mean,
I just went along and found someone who looked as though they were in charge, and which was the local storekeeper, who was a flying officer, a flight attendant in the Air Training Corps. And we approached him, and he asked us for a form and all this sort of stuff, and that's what we wanted to do if we went into the Air Force eventually and this sort of thing. And he puts it with a group of things about you go to those chaps there and they'll show you all the various things we went rifle through and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I want to take you through the activities you did. Did you have a uniform with them?
Yes, I did. Yes,
could you describe it?
It was a heavy quality RF blue uniform with buttons right to the top. The jacket that we just rolled about the same here. And
was that supplied for? They won't be able to see it on the tape, so perhaps we'll take a copy of it.
We had a forage cap and trousers, of course, and we were told to wear black shoes and a blue shirt if we had them. No, you couldn't see the shirt because it was underneath the jacket. And that was it.
Who supplied it?
Yes, it was supplied by the ACC. Yeah.
And how regularly were the meets?
Twice a week, sometimes twice a week, and sometimes weekends. We went for 4 weekends in May 1 year up to Irish Station.
I'll come back to that. Now, what about, how did they take you through training? What did they start you with?
With drill, mostly, out of March, drilling is part of discipline training, really, so active orders. That's the whole purpose of it. And so we marched down there. We found foot was quite good, really, and how to swing your arms the correct height and the pace, and all that sort of stuff. And then onto rifle drill afterwards. Well, we didn't have the full-size rifles. We had 22, which is a bit lighter and a bit easier. But they were knock up something as well. They weren't the real thing.
And what sort of rifle drill were you doing? Were you actually learning to shoot? Or?
No, we're learning to present arms and shoulder arms. And
so it's still more drill, really, in a sense. Did teachers have to shoot?
Not really, no. There's no. they taught us a bit of unarmed combat, a bit of some technical Morse code we had to learn there. If you wanted to, if it depends what you wanted to do. If you were going to, if you wanted to be a pilot or something like that, you have aspirations for that, then they give you some basic knowledge of flying. Everybody though, they've got those similar ways. You completed lots of things, and we're going to join the pilot's class and this sort of stuff. So we put a lot of things like that. There were sporting activities involved as well.
Well, let's go through some of that. So the Morse code, how did they go about teaching you it?
There was someone who was living there who knew how to. Saying it, we listened to it with earphones in a schoolroom, and wrote down what we had to learn the code first, and then gradually they speeded up as time went on. And
did you take to it? Because some people can, some people can't.
That's right. It's one of those things. It's one of those things that either you can do it or you can't. And I found up to about 8 words a minute. It was okay. Above that, it was a bit of a struggle. And when it got to 12, I found I was stuck on that for a while in the ACC. And then when I went into the Air Force, I said then, well, that's all right, you'll get your pass, then, no problem. That solved that problem. But yes, up to about 12, and I didn't expect it anymore in the ACC. Really.
So 12 was it, that was it?
Yeah, that's. As we found out in practice, that's even too fast in an aircraft, bumping around the place.
Would that be receiving and sending?
That's right, receiving and sending, yeah. So there's quite a difference, because some people can receive and can't send it. There's a definite technique, which I found the agency didn't teach necessarily correctly. So I found that radio school was the proper technique. If you do it the way they said, it works.
I'll definitely come on to that. Yeah. Would you develop what they call a fist or at that stage? I mean, would you? Would you have a? I mean, could you tell who was sending at that stage? Because eventually people did actually you could tell who was sending it by the way they sent it. But would that sort of thing develop at that stage?
Counsel in doing it. Yes, there are lots of shortcuts one can do to understand it.
But we'll perhaps come on to it. So, but at that stage, none of that had really arisen. No. Were you taught anything else about wireless or radio or telephones or just signalling generally?
Not really, signalling generally. Not really. It was too technical a subject to discuss, if you like, in one evening a week.
So it's just Morse. Now, what about you said? What else would you do before? Perhaps you get into the pilots. You said that they'd take you through various things, and then eventually you'd do the pilots. But what else might you do before you got to the pilots? So was that?
I'm trying to recall. We only went for an hour or a couple of hours, shall we say, once a week, and. By the time we'd assembled, things were read out to us of what's happening and what's going to happen. And we divided up into classes. It seemed to be the little into classes or groups. And each group did something different, perhaps. And some weeks you were concentrating on Morse code, and other weeks you might be concentrating on something else. They tried to divide us up like they do scout groups. And so it was a similar pattern, really. And now and again, someone would come along and talk about the Air Force too, and they wanted to join stuff.
Did they tell you much about? I mean, it hadn't been in existence that long, but did they tell you about the Royal Flying Corps in the First World War, the history of the RAF?
Not really, no.
RAS?
No, they didn't actually, no. Not whilst I was in it. They might have done until earlier, if they were in it, a bit earlier than me, perhaps, but they didn't think it relevant, perhaps.
And what would they be telling the pilots' classes?
Well, it was a lot different to what we were doing, really, except that trying to inspire them a bit, I think, and talking about aerodynamics and principles of it, perhaps, and to make it simple for all kids, really. And even in those days, people didn't really know what made an airplane fly properly. It's very basic stuff. And we all went through had a basic idea of what flying was all about, but as far as the Air Force is concerned, nothing else. Actual context.
Now, what about the four? You had four weekends.
This was in at Halton in Buckinghamshire, which was then the RAF apprentice school. And I don't know why the rest of each of these weekends in a train without lights in a few tunnels in pitch darkness at the moment, the cold that we were around present instrument. And then we were met and taken onto the camp, and we were given. We were there just on the Saturday, and we went back on the Sunday. And there we were in it. We were given a knife and fork and spoon, and Mr. Timber said, "Well, you're part of the RAF now, and you do exactly what everyone else does. And it's your first indoctrination into what it might be like at the lowest possible level, if you like, really." And so there we did all sorts of activities at RAF time. We were actually working alongside and watching them doing drill and helping them doing it yourself after you've been told how it should be done. Just sort of thing. They were straightening out what the ACC might have missed in their teaching.
What did you think when you saw this sort of RAF discipline and lifestyle in action? I mean,
well, it was strange, really. I picked feelings about it. I thought, This isn't quite the image I have of things, really. Where are the aeroplanes, really? This my thought. Was it around my camp, which is aircraft then? But they weren't bomber or fighter aircraft. They were training aircraft. They were old-fashioned sort of stuff, really. And the chaps mostly were taking bits of them to go because they were engineering apprentices and things like that. So I thought, I hope it's not going to be all like this sort of stuff, really. But I understood that one had to do a lot of classroom work before you get near an aeroplane, so I accepted it.
What about the discipline and, let's say, lack of privacy, things like that? They're obvious.
That came as a culture shock to me, because I've never been away on a camp, I've never been abroad, I've never been with anybody else in the house except my own, really. So this was something new to me, and I thought, well, if I'm going to be in the Air Force at some stage, I better understand it and get on with it. There's no point in fighting it. If I'm going to fight it, I might as well not even think about it. So that's why I put it up there, because it's quite the same as the little thing, but it was near to it. And I thought, well, if it's going to be like this, then okay, I'll cope, best I can, really. And that was a bit of a culture shock, really, because the people, as it turned out, of course, the chaps who were never ran into the Air Force on that, or never saw them again. And they were a different type anyway. So they might have been the ground chaps, but there was a difference by the section was done. It's wrong, really, in a way, but that's how things worked out in those days. And,
you said there was a training aircraft there. Did you get a flight? I mean, were you taken up? Because you wouldn't have been it before then. Or did you get a flight?
I went to Heston Airfield a few weeks later. The weather was too bad. It took us up at Halton. And that was supposed to be on the last weekend. It never took place. But a few weeks later, we went visiting Heston as a group. And we were taken up in an airspeed Oxford, which is in the museum, I was just saying. And to me, that was that made it, that put it together for me. That one flight, 20 minutes, half an hour, there was six of us or seven of us in this aircraft. I was a bit worried when they all wanted to look out of one side, I thought the plane was going to go there. Because that sort of, no idea what it was like, you see, really. You see a plane from outside flying, you know what's going on, you don't know what it's like inside, you don't know. And in those days, plane made goes all the way. And then I was there to be locked, and then I got back home masters. And father opened the front door, and she said, there was a guy, I said, look, you're looking at someone who's had 20 minutes flight in an airplane. I said, what, you've been up in an airplane? You actually went up in it? Oh dear, she said,
You weren't nervous at all.
Yeah, I suppose I was nervous, yes. I think I was nervous. Because not knowing, this thing of not knowing what could happen. You think all sorts of nasty things have happened, because they very rarely do I do sometimes, but it's not necessary to do. And so, yeah, I was nervous, but later on in life, of course, all the flying distance since the Air Force days, I haven't seen that.
And there were no other special days out to RAF stations?
No, sort of shortly after that, I volunteered for the Air Force, and
Now, had you any interest in the insides of aircraft? You know, not aircraft, radios and things. I mean, had you done a cat's whisker radio or anything like that beforehand?
I've had that. My father made one of those when I was a kid, and so that fascinated me. The whole thing, the idea of communication without wires, so to speak. Fascinating, you know, so
had you made one yourself, or
not then? No, I made one subsequently. When I was in the Air Force, I made one, but not before. No.
Now, why did you decide to volunteer? I mean,
to try and make sure. I think the real reason is to try and make sure that I had a chance of doing what I wanted to do in the force, rather than be told you're going to be a so-and-so because you worked in an officer. You're going to be ground staff, and I thought, well, the only way to do what I wanted to do was to volunteer. Volunteering was, it wasn't really, it's only a procedure rather than a desire, if you know what I mean. It was, I thought, I've got to get in there and win the war staff, or anything like that, so it was just that I thought, well, I'm going to be in there, so let's try and do that. And that was, I hadn't done this flight having an interest in that. I think this was the thing to do, it's the only way to do it. And of course that played pitfalls as well.
Would you have minded if you'd been put in the infantry? I mean, your father had a bad time in the infantry.
I being in the army, no. I don't think I would have coped so well. It depends really what I was doing really, but something happened with me. In the Navy didn't work, I couldn't swim, so perhaps put me off the Navy, and yet maybe that might have been.
So, by volunteering, you hope to get the control to allow you to go to your choice, your DRAF.
That's right. Yeah, but I thought my physical size might be a drawback. I think almost was.
How tall were you then?
About 5'2". My weight was 7'4". That was the thing that worried me a bit. But indeed, that almost stopped the whole thing.